Speaker is Renee Olate, who's going to talk about harm reduction community interventions for youth gang violence in El Salvador. He's an assistant professor at Ohio State University College of Social Work, received his doctoral training in social work at Washington University. And he's conducted cross-national research on youth and worked as faculty and international consultant in several countries in the Latin American region. Dr. Olate is currently conducting a longitudinal study about high-risk and gang-involved youth in San Salvador. He publishes in English and in Spanish, so welcome.
Thank you, Marianne. Thank you for being here, to all of you, too. I teach international social development, and I always ask to my student, what is international today? Is not everything international? And this is a very good example, what I'm going to introduce in these 15 minutes of everything is international today. Here is my passion in some way, that we can offer better solutions to marginalized kids than lock them up. So it's better to create social intervention in terms of put them in prison because it's too expensive. And I feel like as public health professional, we can try to do a much better job than just criminalize poor kids in communities. So because I have only 15 minutes, I'm going to start with the conclusion. My message about youth violence and gangs in Central America is that we need to do a better job because mano dura or iron fist policy, basically lock them up, have failed miserably in Central America. So what I'm proposing is basically we need to work into evidence-based community interventions, working in the gray area, and this is the complication, working in the gray area. Police in general work very well in black and white, and they're very efficient to do a good job there. But when we are working with marginalized kids, we need to emphasize the gray area. So I'm proposing basically harm reduction, interventions and desistance strategies. And now I'm going to show you what I'm going to do basically. A background about youth violence and gang in Central America. I would like to tell you this big problem that we have that is completely connected with this country. And I'm going to provide some evidence about this partnership that we created with a youth organization in El Salvador and Guatemala, which is working directly with youth gang members. So this is very unique about this research. It's not about high-risk youth, it's about active gang members. I'm not going to explain one paper, I'm going to give you a summary. This is like the paper that we have published from this research, and we have a couple of papers under review. So I'm not going to talk about any of this specific paper, I would like to give you a big picture about that. And this is the big picture. This is a publication from United Nations, the Global Study on Homicide, and you have here the most dangerous region in the world today. The famous Northern Triangle of Violence. And you have there Honduras, the most violent country in the world today with 82.1, the homicide rate. Then El Salvador, Belize, and Guatemala. And many people refer to the Northern Triangle of Violence, but probably we should say a square now because Belize is next to Guatemala. As you can read there, Central America is now considered the most violent region in the world. And I should clarify that this is outside of a formal war, outside a formal conflict. This is a little bit of perspective of what happened in these countries. You can see in red is Honduras, and you can see this steady increase in terms of like death in Honduras. And then you can see some variation, but you can see how these four countries are separated from the rest of the countries in Central America. And you can also see that in spite of all these policies, mano dura policies that have been implemented in Central America, this number has not decreased. And I think this is a serious trouble, a serious problem for everyone. One explanation for that, and probably you are suspecting that, is drug trafficking. and you can see the roots of drug trafficking there from Colombia, from Peru, from Bolivia, how mostly cocaine is traveling through the north. And I'm not saying that is the only explanation, but probably this is one of the most important sources to explain the level of violence in Central America and Mexico. If you can remember one number for this presentation, please take into account this: $177 with 26 cents. And this number is the price of 1 gram of pure cocaine in the United States. 1 gram of pure cocaine is $177. When you see this huge number, you can figure out the huge incentive that they have in Central America or in South America for mobilizing this product. At the same time, the good news in the US, we are consuming less cocaine than in the past, and is 74% cheaper than a decade ago. So the main route of cocaine to the US is through Central America and Mexico, and you can see the map there. So authorities from this country were very happy. They say, we control trafficking from the Caribbean. We did a good job. So the demand is so high that what happened is exactly all Central America and Mexico is the new route of cocaine. So they control the Caribbean, good job. So the demand is still there. The problem is in Central America and Mexico. Just to give you an idea about what the problem is here, this is formal data from United Nations too. So in order to mobilize cocaine from South America to the border in Mexico and the US, it's a $6 billion industry. One is in the US, it's a $29.5 billion industry. So the explanation of violence, on when we see all this violence in Central America and Mexico, we should really refer to the big incentive that it is here. Now I'm going to enter into the issue of gangs. This is a huge debate about what is gang and what is not a gang. And please believe me, they have invested hours and hours and papers defining what is a gang and what is not a gang. This is a definition from probably 100 researchers from Europe and the US. This is a Klein is a very important sociologist from California, and they came up with this definition. A street gang is any durable, street-oriented youth group whose involvement in illegal activity is part of its group identity. This is more or less the consensus about the definition. What is important for me is what is below. The boundaries between gang and non-gang can be ambiguous or even arbitrary. So this is the difficult part. How you are going to say that this is a gang member, this is a kid who is part of the gang or is not part of the gang. And the border, the tension between this border is, to me, the most important part. Gang versus high-risk youth. So it's very difficult to create an intervention in which you are going to say this is just for high-risk youth or this is just for gang. So our intervention should go into both sides. Gangs versus organized crime. Gangs are so different. Even the same cell, I mean, even into the same gang structure, the same confederation of cells, you have such a huge diversity. So it's not that all of them are organized crime with high level of arms. No, this is not. And this is another message from me. Gangs is not the same than DTOs, which is a sophisticated name to say drug cartels, drug trafficking organizations. It's not the same. Sometimes they are working together, sometimes they are allies, but it doesn't mean that they are the same organization. In fact, we have evidence from Guatemala in which when the gangs are bothering the cartels are going to kill all the kids of the gang. And when I say all the kids, it's literally all the kids in this community that are part of the gang. Violence and youth gangs in El Salvador, 66 homicides per 100,000 inhabitants, as you just read. This is more than 270% of Latin America. So we are talking about one of the huge area of violence there, the second largest worldwide. And we have these two gangs, two confederation of gangs, Mara Salvatrucha, MS-13, and 18th Street. There are more than 28,000, according to the formal data, this is from the police, more than 28,000, and there are 9,500 in prison. So this is a relation to 1 to 3. Being in El Salvador with these kids, you can say that this is not true. I mean, this number is probably 40, 50,000 kids. With different level of violence, different level of delinquency, as I mentioned before. The problem is that these youth gangs are growing, and not the opposite. They are responsible for 30% of the nation homicide, and they are responsible for 90% of the extortion-related crime, la renta, which means that basically most of the citizens of this country hate youth gang members. Our Central American youth, no age group is more likely to be victimized or perpetrate violence in this region, probably in many regions of the world. I always like to put faces, and I like to put faces that are showing victimization. They are showing violence. They are showing dead people. They are showing people in prison. I said that most people in this country hate gang members and hate gangs, which is true. But at the same time, they are the faces of marginalized communities. And unfortunately, they are not the damn kids in these communities, but the opposite. They are the brilliant kids of communities in general. This is a problem that is coming from here. We export these gangs. The origin of Mara Salvatrucha and 18th Street is in California, both gangs. And these gangs spread out in Central America and Mexico. MS-13 and 18 are in several states in the U.S., formally between 42 and 37 in 50 states. So in the majority of the states, we are going to have these gangs. They're in Canada, they're in Mexico, and they're in Europe. In Mexico, they're in 24 out of 32 states. Of course, in the Northern Triangle of Violence, this is also a product of immigration policy and deportation. Contributing factor is mass media and law enforcement policies. So mass media are exacerbating this problem when they are portraying youth gang members. There are some sensationalistic programs that are showing the gangs in TV. And one of the big problems is mano dura, policies and other suppression tactics. This is just a number about deportation to Central America from this country. I'm not saying that all of these deportees are gang members, but a significant percentage of them are gang members. So basically, we export the culture of gangs from California, from the US to Central America. These gangs didn't exist in the past there. Factors involved in the formation of youth gangs, culture of violence and history of civil wars. This is the history in Central America in general. We have poverty, social exclusion, and inequality, the drug transit and proliferation of illicit firearms, many problems in the family structure, the growing youth population, rapid and disorganized urban development, and, of course, the anti-gang law enforcement efforts. I'm trying to highlight here what social scientists from El Salvador are saying about this phenomenon. They say that this is very complex social phenomenon. It results from an interplay of several factors. It is associated with the problem of social violence in each country. And here I'm citing Gaborit, who is a professor with a PhD in social psychology, which is not common in Central America to find people with PhDs. And he states, while violence has ceased to be political, it is embedded in the fabric of a society that is characterized by being mercantilist, fragmented, punitive, individualistic, neglectful, and irresponsible with respect to its obligation toward children and youth. This is not new. We can't speak about new gangs here. It's new, the intensity of the problem today. It is the result of historically constructed social processes, and it has a variety of expression and forms. And please, again, I'm highlighting the message, youth gang is not the same than DTO. It's not the same than drug cartels. our research, we are very lucky to have access to them. I can be honest with you, the IRB of the structure of the game was more strict than the IRB of the university. I don't have access to do qualitative research. I just have access to do survey. And of course, there are questions that they ban. They say, no, you can't ask that. And I say, OK, no problem. We started with this data collection in 2010. We already collected two cohorts, 2010 and 11. And now we are starting to collect number three. And we hopefully are going to have 500 youth. Of course, that will be impossible for me, an outsider of El Salvador, if I don't have access to this youth organization. This is a human rights organization that is saying, basically, that there are more... This is my timing that I didn't finish in 15 minutes.
Yeah, so you're doing fine.
3 minutes. Would be impossible for us to have access to this organization, to this structure. And they were, like, very honest with me. Of course, from these kids who are part of the gang, who are part of the sample, many of them are in prison, or many of them are dead. So it's not easy to do a longitudinal study when you know that they are going to be in prison or they are going to be dead. And this is the case of many of them. And it's complicated because I'm not saying they are saints, quite the opposite in many ways. But I believe that we can create better opportunities than just kill them or put them in prison. Responding, we are recruited by staff members by means of snowball or change referral sampling. We have the traditional measurement, delinquency, violence, substance abuse, and others. When I say other, is any measure that can help us to say that they're not just criminal, they are more than that. For example, we are using empathy, we are using religiosity, we are using discipline, parental discipline, anything that we can show that we can do something, we can create interventions for them. This is a summary of evidence about some of the papers and my experience there. High-risk youth and youth gang involved are similar to high-risk youth in the US, and unfortunately, this is very sad. I was a professor at Boston College, and we collect data in Chelsea, and we could see how similar these marginalized kids were, with the exception of a higher level of violence and delinquency. Youth gang members, of course, exhibit high level of risk behaviors. One of the main factors that explain violence is exposure to violence. And this is from the last cohort that we got this data. So if you are exposed to violence, you are going to be more violent, which makes sense, right? But this is what we are seeing. The second generation of youth gang members is already active, so it's the son of the active gang members, so the guy who are 40-something, they have kids, and they are already gang members. Youth gang are extremely adaptable to the environment. So El Salvador, unfortunately, in democracy, put the army in the street in order to control the problem of violence. Yes, they decrease the level of violence in some way, but this is the cost of governance, so we need to have the army in the streets, which is not very nice. Youth gang effectively control some communities, and the problem is with the police and the army in the communities in the streets, they were making mistakes. They were arresting kids who were not gang members. So if you are a father and your kid is arrested, are you going to support the gang structure, or are you going to support the police? And the answer is simple, right? Youth gangs are growing, and they are functioning as a social movement. And again, I'm not supporting the gang. I'm not saying that I like the gang, because they shouldn't exist. But I think that we should do a better job. The solution, evidence-based community intervention, working in the gray area, message, mano dura, or iron face policies miserably fail. Harm reduction intervention is what we need, and the system strategies. And we need basically this public health approach to community-based prevention and intervention. Harm reduction in terms of drug use, violence, and delinquency for these kids who are in the gang. And we need to support venues to be out of the gang, which is very difficult, but we need to support that in terms of employment, marriage, and a stable relationship, and association, sport, and churches. And of course, the question is how to increase the levels of social capital and collective efficacy in these communities. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. I wonder if I could get the three panelists to sit up here now.
thought these were really three very interesting presentations. And by the way, Chen Chen, who is supposed to be the fourth speaker, not here, right? Okay. It's funny, but it was a session where the final speaker came up at the end. One thing I found really interesting about these three presentations, it's all about urbanization, problems of urbanization, but it's very clear that it's not just a question of living in the country or living in a city. It's about social and economic change, and very specifically about poverty and inequality that is very much drivers in the kinds of problems and needs that they're talking about. So, do we have questions from the group or comments? Any observations you've had? Yeah.
Well, I've been to a couple of sessions today, and this is definitely the most intriguing thing to do. Questions about what you're speaking about. It's very helpful to be here all day. But I had a question for you with the gang violence in South America. When you talk to the kids who are actually either in the gangs or who are the high-risk kind of population, how receptive are they to not being in the gang, and what are their biggest complaints or barriers to why, if they're already in a gang, they don't want to leave that, besides, you know, the maybe penalties from the gang itself?
Thank you for your question. I'm great that you're enjoying the conference. Gangs in Central America or in many parts of the world are religion. It's like a sect. So it satisfies different kind of needs. And when you're living in marginalized communities, to be a gang member is to have access to power and resources. So it's like it's unfortunately one of these paradoxical situations in which these marginalized poor kids find a way to have power and access.
Do you think it's like a trap? I'm just curious. Like a tribal feeling,
you have
a home?
Well, many of them don't have the figure, the parental figure, the father figure, so they don't have this formal family which is providing support. So it's like the family for them is the gang. So it is very difficult for them to be out of the gang, because tattoos in your face or in your body means a strong ascription to the gang structure. So it's very complicated when we see that, in spite of all these policies, all what they are doing there, we have more youth gang members today than 5 years ago. And the problem is we have more youth in prison, too. I don't know if I answered your question.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes.
I was wondering, is there much intergenerationality, transferring from, fathers were in the gang and then their sons. So there's not a lot of father support for some of the gang members, but for the ones that are there, is there any observation of intergenerational gang membership?
Unfortunately, this is what we are seeing now, that we have the second generation of kids, and they have the family. The entire family is supporting the gang. And the problem is entire communities are supporting the gang with the problem of violence from police. So if dividing the country in some way, you are supporting the police, which is the majority of the population are supporting the police, no doubt. But in poor communities, the majority of the population are not supporting the police. And this is one of the governance problems in Central America today. And I would like to insist, I'm completely against drug cartels. I hate what they are producing in Mexico and Central America. But youth gang members are not descendant DTOs.
Yes.
I had a question about the immigrants' non-intentional death.
Mm-hmm.
Now, looking at what you proposed, how we could solve the issues, a lot of structural, putting up roadblocks, putting up lights, mm-hmm. car seats, that kind of thing. But when I listened to your presentation, it's all of that aspects of race, and it's necessary. So does that come into play? So for instance, if I am an immigrant in the UAE and I'm on a bicycle and I get hit, does the ambulance take longer to arrive? Does the police take their time? Do people actually volunteer to put me in their car?
Within the UAE in particular, they actually require people almost having funds to put money in a healthcare system. So it is one place that immigrants do have healthcare. So they have the very similar healthcare opportunities, probably better than low-income people in the United States, than citizens do. So we haven't found that lack of care there is a problem. It's lack of sidewalks, lack of training, driver's training. And it may be pretty rich UAE citizens driving a car that kills themselves, but a bunch of pedestrians too. The top soccer player in the UAE was supposed to be like the top one in the world, got killed like 2 years ago, and they were by a car. He was driving and got in the traffic to do that, and they were trying to find his coach to tell him. He was another soccer player's death from a traffic accident. So if you're poor and you're walking, if you're poor and you're riding a bicycle, those are probably more important at determining whether you're going to get killed in a traffic accident than in the UAE, than the type of care you actually get. Now, in rural China, there they said it does make a difference in how long it takes to get you to the hospital. In the UAE, the only problem is if there's a traffic jam, you can't get to the hospital. That could happen to anybody. Same thing if you're trying to evacuate there. It'd be terrible. So it's a little different by each culture, but in the whole, in Africa, in the Arab state, and in China, in India, all those rapidly urbanizing places, people are getting killed by cars. They're not necessarily in the car when it happens. But in other words, the driver may get killed, but pedestrians and bicyclists and motorcyclists get killed too. I come from a state where they don't require you to wear a helmet, which is really stupid in Indiana. So there are a lot of things that aren't being done overseas. There are some things we should be doing here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and in there.
Crystal, Sachin, so I was interested whether you're using it as a supplement or as a main water source, or the Dominican Republic has seen an increased use of supplements, usually when folks are up, you know, in the bus or traveling, but at home they still want underwater source, so really a supplement. So I guess my question in your context is that, and then if it is sort of a mixed water source, how you sort of tease that apart looking at sort of the impacts on the challenges there.
Okay, good question. So it grew out of, when it first came on the scene, it grew out of, you want to think of it as recreational drinking water on the go, right? It was originally people vending water on the street corner, an open bucket and a cup. And obviously there are all kinds of sanitary issues with that. And then it progressed to being in a plastic bag that was just an open bag, same thing. And then they started tying the bag. It was not at first natural. So it gradually evolved into the steel package, but now with, you know, we're talking 15 years ago, 20 years ago, this whole evolution is happening. Population is, urbanization is happening, population is continuing to grow. Suddenly, it wasn't just a need for water on the go, it was a need for water in the home because of the water rationing that's been implemented over the last decade or so. So you are actually now seeing the shift of people using sachet water as the primary drinking water source in the home, where they may not even keep any water in the home at all. It may just be over the course of the day they purchase 3 to 4 of these sachets to drink, and that's all they've got. And maybe they're still using water by the bucket or from some other unsavory source for household chores, for washing dishes, and cleaning clothes and bathing and so forth. Occasionally you see people even using sachet water for that because that's all that they can physically get their hands on. But yes, in fact, one of the sub-studies, we were looking in 37 neighborhoods classified according to UN criteria as slums. So an entirely low-income slum population, and 50% of households were using sachet water as their primary water source. That in and of itself was a shocking shocking result. And this all happened in the space of about 5 years. It came on the scene and suddenly everybody's relying on it. And we think that the numbers are only going up. In fact, we're still waiting on the Ghana 2010 census to come out. They're having all sorts of coding and scanning problems. But we're waiting on that data. We're pretty sure that that's citywide, not just with low-income populations.
I'm dying to ask a follow-up question.
That's approaching 50%, maybe even 60%. There are definitely some neighborhoods where 80-90% of residents are using sachet water.
In another life, in the late 70s, one of my jobs was testing public and private water supplies in North Carolina. And many small communities' water supplies did not pass the test. And in fact, part of that time, the Asheville water system was so bad that you couldn't put it on the airplane in the Asheville airport. So any time, and that was when you had water that had pressure behind it every single day. When you say to me, you've got water Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I go, eh, that means there's not constant pressure in those pipes. And any time the pressure isn't going out a leak, stuff is coming in, bacteria, contaminants. So anytime you don't have 24-hour pressure 7 days a week, you've got contaminants in the water system. So I'm like, okay, are these 10 people taking water out of one spigot on Monday, putting it in a sachet and sealing it up and handing it to somebody? But that doesn't necessarily mean it's pure water in the sachet just because it got sealed up. I've been in countries where they refill bottles. You know, they figured out how to reseal them. You know, they're refilling bottles. So the quality of the manufacturing or the sealing or the, you know, what kind of certification you have on getting the water into the sealed container, it really concerns me because, to me, it could be the very same polluted water you had before. It can look better. Maybe they filtered it. But it doesn't necessarily have less bacteria or less heavy metals unless you have a certification where people, like swimming pools. If you don't inspect swimming pools, people get your irritated. If you don't inspect the water people that put the water in the sachet, you really don't have a clue what you're getting. So that part kind of creeps me out.
Justin, your answer?
Well, there's a bit of variability there. So a lot of the sachet water on the market is coming from the big corporate beverage manufacturers. It goes through reverse osmosis filtration. It's virtually the same quality you get in bottled. It's not sort of clean. It's really clean water. I mean, it's like what you get from bottled water. And you might pay, you know, on the 3 to 5 cents spectrum, you tend to pay maybe 5 or 6 cents for those brands. You might pay 3 to 4 cents for some of the lower end brands that are more gray market, that are definitely not certified with the government, and they're probably not changing their filters all the time. The water is usually pretty good because to even make it worth setting up one of these operations, you've got to set up a filling station where there's pretty regular water.
Okay.
Not just Monday, Wednesday, Friday. They're usually pumping into filling tanks. They fill these giant poly tanks with water, so they've got backups even if the water does go out occasionally. This kind of stuff usually isn't going on in places where
So are they chlorinating the water in those big tanks probably too?
They're often running the water.
Iodizing, bromidizing, or chlorinating?
Sand filtration and UV disinfection.
No, I mean some sort of disinfection in addition to a filtration, either by bromide or iodide or chlorine or oxygen.
Well, it's municipal water, so it's already been chlorinated.
Okay, good. That's good.
So that's why when you test water coming into the city, the residual chlorine is usually pretty good. By the time it gets to a household or a business, that residual chlorine often is close to zero. So it definitely... The existing network loses about half the water that goes through.
So the city is purifying it, they're just not getting it to anybody or much people.
Okay, other questions out here?
I wanted to ask a question of you, the lady talking about unintentional injuries.
Sure.
And I was curious about the falls. I know that many people go to the Arab world to work. So when you're talking about immigrants, what you're talking about is expats who go there to work.
Absolutely.
So when you're talking about falls, I was wondering, you separate citizens from immigrants. Is there any kind of data about work-related falls?
The data collection is so bad we've been harassing people to improve it, but some of the things that the Labor Department has done is in the hottest part of the day, they've made laws that you cannot require people to work outside, particularly in holiday situations, things like that. But the data collection is awful. So that you cannot, just like you can't tell exactly how the traffic accident happened, they're just going to put a check, this person died from a fall. You don't know if they died at home. You don't know if they died at work. But the assumption is if you're from probably somewhere other than Europe or the United States and you're an expat and you died from a fall, it very likely could be at work. But the data, you cannot guarantee that from the data that exists currently. That's reported in a general level, it's sad. But in places like India, they're using, for scaffolding, they're using tied together bamboo. and they're not using any fall protection. So if those are the things they used at home, and then they come to the UAE to work, then their knowledge of what's appropriate and what you ought to have is very low, too. Does that make sense?
Other questions? Anybody that, yeah, go ahead.
How much does
the
water cost? How much do you
mean?
The
cost.
I'm
trying to calculate how much.
Cost.
Like how much is in or how much does it cost?
Maximum milliliters, about 300 to 500 milliliters, depending on where you purchase them.
No, not 40 cents.
4 cents.
Right.
Not as bad as it sounds, but still.
Still too
like
much.
50 times more than you pay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm working on dengue fever, so I was wondering whether water test shales is correlated with a decrease of, you know, stagnating water, better vector control.
That's a great question. Something that I actually am moving towards investigating, but in a roundabout way. There's virtually no dengue fever surveillance in a crop, which sounds ridiculous because we know the vector's there and you've got to show your yellow fever vaccination when you enter the country so you know there's Aedes aegypti there. And we're pretty sure it's transmitting, and we're pretty sure that a lot of the overdiagnosis of malaria is in fact things like dengue or West Nile or chikungunya or fill in the blank. And no one's looking at that right now, and that's something I'm starting to get into. But as far as I have not actually yet conducted any household container surveys or anything like that, starting to look for breeding. It's got to be there, but we haven't started that. It's a great question.
You guys are a great audience. It's so nice to have questions. Sometimes people just.
I have a second one, sorry. I was wondering whether the water tests here are used also in refugee camps. I mean, it's like, you know, it's almost a slum situation. So, is tested there or not?
I haven't seen that in West Africa. It certainly is very similar. It's very similar conditions living in slums as in a refugee camp. The stories that I'm hearing from other people who do work with refugee camp populations is that they're starting to see that. Was certainly used in Haiti following the earthquake when you had hundreds of thousands of people displaced to different cities. I'm aware of sachet water in parts of India. It's come and gone in certain East African countries. Right now, it's really a West African phenomenon. It started in Nigeria and Ghana and has pretty much fanned out to pretty much every country contiguous to either of those. So from Abidjan to Yaoundé, pretty much everything that's whole.
Interesting.
I actually had a question going back to the youth gang discussion. This might be a hard question, but I was wondering, part of the conceptual guiding principles of your work is that you can steer youth away from these gangs, and that there's another way, that there could be other types of outlets for youth social behavior and so forth, right? So my question is, have you gotten a qualitative sense of whether there's some threshold at which point you can't reel them back? In other words, is there a point, whether it's a certain number of years of involvement, where they just become that stereotypical hardened criminal that just is no longer capable of rehabilitation? What are your thoughts on that?
Add to that, how's it different from the mafia? Sounds like mafia.
Well, it is a kind of mafia, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this country, the history of mafia in this country is associated with the history of immigrants.
Yeah.
Like Italian mafia, then you have the Irish gang, you have the Jewish gang. I mean, if you check the history of
Chinese
this country,
mafia?
You are going to see all the, what is it, gangs associated with new immigrants and how they are getting a place into main society. I was at Boston College, and the origin of Boston College was exactly the creation of outlets for these kids who were Italian or Irish who couldn't go to Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
They were not accepted because they were Catholic. So this is the origin of that. So the question of that is, yes, it's kind of like a normal process in any society, not just here. Your question requires the longitudinal vision, right? And there are just a few research that they have longitudinal perspective about that. I'm going to tell you, what I put there was like the evidence from this longitudinal study about what we can do. But my common sense perspective is really important too. I feel like it's stupid to say that we are going to end with the game, but we are going to eliminate the game. It's impossible. So we shouldn't put all our efforts there. For that reason, the effort to me is like, how are we going to influence the structure of the game? And how we're going to make some basic influence there? And at the same time, how we're going to fight, not directly, but how we're going to offer opportunities for some of the kids to get out of the game. And that, for me, is like the emphasis, and this is where we should go in general. And to me, it's very sad to see the money, how it's going to Central America about prevention.
Mm.
And they said, yes, prevention. No, we need to intervene. We need to influence the game, not just prevention. Because the game is continue growing and growing and growing. So to me, the issue is how we're going to, and in this country they are not very popular, but how we're going to emphasize harm reduction policies. I mean, in Europe, they are very popular, these kind of policies, and unfortunately here, they are not. And I think that they are cheaper and they have more efficient than just the traditional repression policy. We don't need to put more computers to the police in Central America, which is the traditional international cooperation. We are going to provide more training to the police with more computers and more technology. The problem with the big incentive there, which is drug, is that the poor kids are not managing the business of the drug in Central America. They are not. They are like big powerhouses that are connected with big mafia in this country, in Mexico, and in Central America and South America. They are not living in these marginalized communities. So there are possibilities, of course, and I'm full of hope. And I believe that we can do well with them. It is difficult? Yes. It is growing the problem? Yes.
Do you think it could be a positive social structure if you could just get rid of the violence?
I always dream with like an intervention in which we can use the cell phone, because the basic way of communication is cell phone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they are communicated in some way with LA, with Chicago, with Washington DC. It's a really powerful network, right? If we can have access and we can negotiate some basic intervention to reduce some risk behaviors, for example, I feel like we can move. It's very difficult to say that in a context where most people are seeing, again, cartels and gangs are the same, and they are not.
I just had a comment on this. I don't know if you are aware about, you know, gaming and how gaming can have an impact on society and serious games. And there is Jane McGonigal from the Institute for the Future with here in Palo Alto, who's been developing several games. I don't know if, you know, gang youth might be attracted to that and it can help behavior change. So this is just an idea, and you know, that could be
interesting.
Yeah, it's a fun.
Any other last question? Well, I'd really like to thank this panel. I think we've had some fabulous sort of new insights onto some of the new angles on some of the issues around urbanization, and you just all did a great job, and thank you very, very much.
Thank you.